Hey, this is Lucas Barfield, and welcome back to On the Record.
And we are here this week for On the Record with a special guest, and we are joined by Devin Rydell Kelly, who is running for the 27th LD House seat in Olympia against Jake Fye. How are you doing today, Devin?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me, Lucas.
Yeah, it is really great to have you on the show, and I wanted to jump right into the interview. But before we get into your politics and some more information about your campaign, tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks so much. I've been really lucky to spend my entire adult life as a community organizer, starting in Idaho when I was 18 years old. In 1998, I was just thrown into activism and organizing right when I got out of college, including becoming the co-founder of an organization called the Idaho Progressive Student Alliance, where I really cut my teeth as an organizer and learned about politics, learned about inequities through helping organize for a campaign for minimum wage for migrant farm workers. And growing up in rural Idaho was interesting. I grew up in a kind of a wealthy ski resort town, and I had parents that were connected with wealthy folks. They were artists and musicians, but it always kind of struggled financially. And so we were surrounded by a lot of kind of wealth and kind of liberal, well-meaning politics, but also a lot of rural poverty and a lot of racism. And I had trouble really articulating, understanding what was going on and what was causing all the problems. And then, you know, went to a college class and learned a bunch of words and realized that there was a bunch of racialized capitalism going on, and jumped headfirst into politics. And I've been just doing political organizing ever since. I've lived in Tacoma for about the last 10 years. Own a home on Hilltop with my partner. I really love it. I work on Hilltop at the Foundation for Tacoma Students as a director of research, evaluation, and data. And I've been lucky spending my paid career doing kind of research around real education equity for the last decade. So at FFTS for the last 5.5 years, and at Service Employees International Union Local 925 for about 6 before that. So researching labor markets, researching union organizing, researching UW and K-12 education. All of my learnings through all this have driven me to really just want to really push profound education reform in Washington. I was involved in the fight in 2010 to try to get an income tax. And I think that so much of the inequity and problems we see right now are a result of us not really being able to transform the tax code a long time ago. So yeah, there's a lot of things that inform my views and my life. And I've just really, really been really lucky to be involved in a lot of great movement work and connected to a lot of great folks throughout the Northwest and now here in Tacoma.
Yeah, thanks so much for sharing. And I wanted to ask you, I have seen you say that you were running as a progressive Democrat, and I do also know that you're a proud Democratic Socialist. Where do those two political ideologies intersect, and how do they inform your politics?
Yeah. You know, I've always believed in this concept of the radical imagination. How do we envision a world that we want to get to? And then what are the strategies and tactics that it takes to get us there? And I think that's why I've long identified as a democratic socialist. I believe that we need to kind of shift to a new way of managing society that's democratic and controlled by the people. And that, you know, the only way to get there is through mass organizing and building a community, whether it's through politics, labor unions, or other organizations. I'm also practical and realistic. I understand that, you know, the current landscape we live in politically, we have a two-party system. In Washington, it's really kind of a one-party state. I'm not a burn it all down kind of person. I really believe in coalition politics and bringing people together. And I think that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party in Washington is more or less aligned with most of my values and a lot of fellow travelers in that space. So I don't see any contradictions in that. I think that what we need are all sorts of people coming from all sorts of different backgrounds to work together to transform society towards, you know, empowering the multiracial, multigenerational working class.
So speaking of coalition building, I know you were involved recently in the Tacoma for All Initiative 1 to increase renters' rights here in Tacoma. Tell us a little bit about what it took to get that initiative passed and some things that it does. And what still needs to be done on the local and state level when it comes to housing?
Those are great questions. You know, so first off, what Initiative One does, we've been able to achieve the boldest tenant protections in Washington state, including protecting families with school children and educators from eviction in the school year and any evictions in winter months. and forcing landlords to provide relocation assistance if they raise the rent too much and tenants can't afford it over 5%. There's a whole lot of other protections in there that I think are crucial, a longer window for notice of rent increases, capping fees to 1 month equivalent for move-in costs and all manner of other fees. But really, it's the eviction protection and relocation assistance that I think is the most powerful way of pushing back against this highly commodified housing market that is on the backs of working people, whether it's homeowners or renters. And it was a big fight. You know, we tried to influence the Home in Tacoma rezone process and work with the city to convince them to do a lot of this stuff through ordinance. We were in strange bedfellows with developers in a weird way for a little bit, and that we wanted the rezone to happen because we do believe in density. We do believe in more housing, but we also believe it has to be equitable and it can't just be giveaways to real estate development, you know? And unfortunately, the developers in the city weren't interested in any of the stuff that we wanted to do at all. And we just had to take it to the people. And, you know, the city had their own process of trying to improve their rental housing code at the same time. We were never opposed to it. We thought they were doing some pretty good stuff, but it was just not sufficient in the moment of crisis we're facing in housing. And they tried to get us to negotiate with them. And we met a few times with the city leaders, with the mayor and a number of folks from council and some staff. And they really wanted to find a compromise position where we gave up on relocation assistance or where we gave up on eviction protections. And we wanted them to move and incorporate that stuff. And we couldn't find a common ground. So we took the signatures to the ballot and we took it to the vote and we won. And it was an amazing people-powered campaign, you know. And those two things, they were the things that resonated most with everyone we talked to on the doors, Warren community, staying housed and the cost of rent. And, you know, when you see those things, how deeply and wildly felt they are, and you see people coming to the vote, coming to the polls for them, you realize that this is what we need to do, you know. In the case of the state, you know, Senator Yasmin Trudeau, who I hope becomes my colleague in this in the legislature, was one of our biggest backers of Tacoma for All and has introduced rent stabilization twice now. And for the first time, a really good version actually made it through the House, but hers, the original one, got killed in the Senate, and then the complementary bill in the Senate to the House bill got killed. So rent stabilization did not make it through. I think we need profound shifts in how the state regulates housing. I think we need rent stabilization. I think we need a state social housing developer. And I actually think we need to create some kind of state public bank to do really innovative things with building housing. So for instance, I would totally support a state public bank that gives low interest loans to homeowners to convert their houses into duplexes or triplexes under the condition that they have rent stabilization or basically rent control for their tenants. And it's a great way to incentivize folks to do that. And it's a great way to bring in folks that are sometimes opposed to things like density because they don't want a bunch of renters in their homeowner neighborhood. The point being though, and I don't mean to ramble, but we need to be thinking really innovatively and really strategically about confronting these big inequities, which I just don't think is what's happening currently.
You know, I first heard your voice and became aware of your work back in 2020 during the police accountability and Black Lives Matter movement that arose after the George Floyd and locally the Manielis tragedies. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot has happened since then. What are some positive things that you have seen come out of those movements and that are still ongoing? What does there still need to be done when it comes to police accountability, both locally in Washington State and even on the national level?
Yeah, again, these are great, urgent, important questions. And I think particularly right now when the moment of the biggest uprisings for Black Lives has passed and there's a bit of a kind of retrenchment around policing and community safety, I think it's really important to interrogate this stuff. You know, I think locally, the creation of Tacoma's non-police crisis response team, the HOPE team, is a really great net positive to come out of the organizing in response to George Floyd and Manny Ellis's deaths. I'm happy to say I was part of a great coalition of folks from multiple organizations that pushed really hard for the city to create that team after there had been demands for many years prior for different types of crisis response. And sometimes it takes a crisis to lead to better response. And over the last two budget cycles, we've been pushing hard for that, and we were able to get it funded in the last one, first at about $800,000 and now up to $2 million. We've been meeting regularly, generally monthly, but recently a couple times a month with the folks on that team, with the leadership of that team, with the fire department, members of the an intentional response coalition to really try to push to get a maximal system where they're dispatched, where they're independent of police and fire, where it's culturally responsive and they can deal with people in community in crisis. We got a long way to go, but they're willing partners, unlike a lot of other folks, I think, that we've dealt with in the city. And I think they understand the urgency of the situation. You know, at the same time, Manny Ellis's murders got off. And it's a profound tragedy. You know, I went down to the courthouse when they announced the verdict and then to the mural to Manny right after, and was just with his family and community members and the Tacoma Action Collective and all the great people doing all the great work and response for years. And I think that justice hasn't been served at all, you know, and that there's many intersecting reasons for that. I think one is that our city, and I think this is reflective of political problems in Washington and more broadly, there's a lot of hand-wringing that goes on. I think the mayor and the city council at first was trying to punt to the city manager. The city manager was trying to punt to the mayor. They were all afraid of, you know, what certain folks in the police and the police union might do. And no one was just willing to be the person accountable for change. At the same time, the person most responsible for the cover-up, you know, ran for sheriff and won. So there's, you know, there's, it's a complex political system with a lot of different forces and a lot of different people. And I think all that's still there. And I think that I'm overjoyed that my friend and now my council representative, Jamika Scott, is on the city council and really pushing for change, but she's embattled and she's, you know, facing, a real uphill fight to trait reform herself because it's so complex and so difficult. But I think that the really important things to remember around this are the way movements work and the way movements work over time, you know. And I went to police accountability protests when I was 18, 19, 20. I remember going to one at Seattle Central in 2002, right after I moved here. And it was always like anarchists, socialists, and the black churches and no one else. And they were always the places where the cops were the most violent to people. To think about the jump between them and now, and to think about what happened in Minneapolis and the fact that the, you know, you could say only 42% of voters voted to get rid of the police department and replace it with a community safety department. Or you could say a whole 43% did, right? And the battle for reform and transformation isn't over. It's got a long way to go, but there's a public consciousness around the fact that policing, that police have to do too much. They have to do what social workers do. They have to do what healthcare providers do. And if we were to fund those programs, we were to fund housing and healthcare and not create these interactions with, you know, people in crisis dealing with violence workers, then society would be way better. Everyone would be way better. The cops would probably be way better. And so, you know, it's, you can call it like a positive abolition model, I guess, you know, that we want to fund these programs. We want to keep people housed. We want to keep people healthy. And that's how we get to, I think, a really fundamental shift in that stuff. It doesn't happen overnight. It's a long movement. It's why they call it the struggle. But I think that there's been huge progress made, even in this moment of kind of political retrenchment. And of a lot of electeds, I think, backing away from the more progressive language they've embraced around that stuff in the last several years.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up, which is what you were saying about the re-entrenchment back around police. I'm on public transportation a lot. I hear people talking out there, what's going on in the city. I'm in Seattle a fair amount on public transportation. I hear what's going on and what's on people's mind. And a lot of people do believe that the police are under attack, that there's no policing going on. And then there's the perception of an uptick in crime, and there's a lot more problems going on in the state, and it's being blamed a lot on the BLM movement and sort of the pushback on police. What would you say to those people out there who are actually really afraid and do have a fear of what's going on in our state, in our communities?
I live on Hilltop. I live near a number of encampments. There's been shootings on my block. I was on a meeting on Zoom once when there was like 15 shots fired, you know, I don't know, 100 feet from my house. I've had a number of my friends and neighbors' homes broken into. And so I think that the sense of safety is real, and we should never deny those experiences. Like, people are, a lot of folks in desperate situations have done desperate things. And a lot of, I think, well-meaning, pretty progressive folks have been impacted on it in ways that make them question some of their values and views around this stuff. So I don't want to be dismissive of that. I think it's really important to acknowledge. I think, you know, there's also been a lot of politics in play around how police forces interact with community and legitimizing narratives for more police that are directly related in the case of Tacoma and a lot of other municipalities to things like police slowdowns and avoiding certain neighborhoods where certain politicians live as a bargaining tactic with unions that no one in the city wants to talk about, that people are afraid of. Mm-hmm. And it is really complex and messy, and it makes it really easy to embrace this narrative of we need more cops. There's also an interesting phenomenon of they're offering a bunch of money for people to become cops and people aren't wanting to do it. So I think that, you know, whether you could say they're not paying cops enough or they're saying people don't want to be police anymore, there's a lot of intersecting pieces there that I think to blame, you know, the BLM movement or to blame certain legislation or Supreme Court cases, it's understandable that you want to find a quick explanation, but it's doesn't lead to the actual change you're seeking, right? So how do we, you know, deal with violent crime while also, you know, protecting our most vulnerable? And there's no perfect solution. I do think that a lot of it comes down to keeping people housed. I think a lot of it comes down to not pushing homeless people around all the time to different places like the camping ban. I think the camping ban in Tacoma has backfired and made things worse. And I think it's around youth engagement. I think that we need significant investment in before and after school programming. I think we need youth jobs. I think a lot of what's happening is young people who are disengaged, bored, don't have a lot of faith in their elders or the system around them. And until we build trust with them, until we build trust across communities, we're going to be facing the same problems over and over again. And putting people in and out of jail and putting people in and out of homelessness, while it gets rid of them immediately and gets them maybe out of your face, the problem's still there. The problem's still there for them. The problem's still there for you. So how do we, I don't have perfect answers for how we address people's sense of safety while also moving kind of more progressive, bold vision on this, other than saying everyone deserves to be heard, everyone deserves to be safe, and let's work together.
I wanted to ask you, where is the 27th LD located?
Yeah, the 27th takes up the top two-thirds of Tacoma. There's a little carve-out on the east side where it used to be part of the 27th, now part of the 25th, and it extends down into Fife. So all of North Tacoma, Northeast Tacoma, Central, down to the mall, Hilltop, West Tacoma.
Well, that would put the NWDC right in the 27th LD. Do you have any ideas about how we can finally close the Northwest Detention Center?
Yeah. You know, I am not an expert on the legal side of NWDC. I think it's another perfect example, though, of how folks at all levels of government have engaged in hand-wringing and kind of blame shifting. I think the city took forever to say we'll not renew permits because it's not our jurisdiction. You know, there's been stuff with the port, the state legislature, and then everyone's blamed Congress. And I think that one thing that's been missing around this is kind of a culture of confronting and delegitimizing the institution, both of kind of incarcerating and deporting folks, but also specifically the institution of the NWDC. And I think there's a bully pulpit that needs to be used of putting all sorts of pressure and public pressure and going to rallies and supporting preventing people from being deported and highlighting the fact that, you know, people can go to court support for immigrants and refugees facing deportation and to fight the deplorable conditions there. I know that, you know, everything around all the hunger strikes recently, everything around the profound concerns with health outcomes, with COVID outbreaks, that I think that people at all different levels of government aren't doing enough to both highlight how terrible the conditions are and find just whatever way to intervene, right? Whether it's legal or political or otherwise. So I would absolutely commit. I'm resolutely opposed to it being here and would do everything in my power to try to get it out of here.
Shifting gears again, I wanted to bring up something that we hear a lot about in the state of Washington, and that is climate change. And there's a lot being done on the state level. But I hear a lot what you're talking about the hand-wringing and the blame shifting. And there seems to be a lot of that going on when it comes to climate change and what we are actually doing. What is your view of the state's current strategy for fighting climate change, in particular the new carbon tax and other things that they're doing to reduce our carbon footprint in Washington State?
Totally. These are great questions, and I think really important ones too. I think that, you know, we need to have much bolder vision about where we go with climate change. We're facing so many different intersecting crises of environmental conditions here at home, and also of climate migration from other places to here. And we're just the beginning of it, right? So there's going to be so many cascading kind of downstream things to come out of climate change that I think that we're struggling to even consider. And I like the concept of future-proofing, and future-proofing is going to be perfect, but we need to basically confront our entire infrastructure, and it starts with our physical infrastructure and our public utilities and moving towards clean energy as quickly as possible without a reliance on transitional fuels and with a just transition for workers in those industries. It means pulling folks out of anything in those industries and getting them the training and the union benefits to do good green jobs with solar, with wind, with other renewables. I've been really excited about the Build Public Renewables Act in New York that just got passed, and it got passed because of DSA in New York. I'm very proud of that. And I think we need something equivalent here. We need major significant investments in renewable energy, and we need to be connected to jobs programs for union workers, jobs programs for people in affected industries, and also Green Youth Job Corps. I'm talking like kids doing trail maintenance and planting trees, you know, trees as carbon sinks. And all of this needs to be done in the form of massive state investments. And we can only make massive state investments if either we're moving towards a public banking model, which I support, or we're changing our tax code, preferably both, right? We're not going to be able to confront real inequities unless we get rid of the inequality that drives them. You know, we have some of the richest people in the world in our state, and they're flying around in their private jets, and their carbon footprints are nothing like mine and nothing like yours and nothing even like the richest people we can possibly imagine. It's so absurdly different, right? And the carbon tax, while I think it's a step in the right direction, as currently implemented, is somewhat regressive. A lot of the different ways we deal with carbon taxation currently is regressive. And we do need to stop people from polluting. We do need to incentivize people to use public transit. But until we identify and address this at the site of production, major manufacturing, major utilities, major infrastructure, we're not going to be able to really fix anything. Future-proofing public utilities and infrastructure and building green housing helps us accommodate the massive influx of climate refugees that we're going to face imminently, if not already.
I wanted to talk accessibility for a second. As a person with a disability, I know how inaccessible government can be at sometimes when it comes to the website or being able to interact with government. But accessibility doesn't always just have to do with disability. It has to do with communities and communities of color and who gets access to who when it comes to running our government. How can we improve accessibility for both people with disabilities, but then some of our marginalized communities that don't always have access to the full range of things within our city and state government?
Yeah, thanks. You know, I believe in kind of a targeted universalist approach to social programs, meaning that the folks that have historically dealt with the most oppression should be the folks that are given the most opportunity. And I think that in the case of accessibility issues, especially in the legislature, the website is woefully inadequate, especially when it's coming to really complex things like bills and identifying where things are in a process. And in terms of translation, transcription for folks that are vision impaired, I think that there's a whole lot of work that could be done in terms of internet access and digital access to our political landscape, both in the state legislature and in local communities. I also think that just a lot of it is obfuscated, it's complex, and jargonistic, and I think there needs to be a lot more plain and simple language and access points for folks that aren't as deeply steeped in the political process, and that includes education and more of an orientation towards civics and keeping folks that are elected in communities actually in community with folks, you know, so much more interacting with their constituents, much more engaging with people. I think also that there's and profound inequity issues around the fact that our legislature is part-time and part-time pay. It means that predominantly white folks can be in the legislature. It means that predominantly retired rich white folks are in the legislature, or small business owners, and that it's the same with our city council, actually, and here in Tacoma and in many other places, that the system is set up so that people that have been historically oppressed don't necessarily have access to that power structure. And then when they do, it's a very tokenized person that is generally has more wealth and resources anyway. So I think that there's a whole lot of functional, practical stuff that can be done around physical infrastructure and accessibility, but then also just being in community and also making the jobs, decent jobs for folks that come out of the working class or come out of an immigrant background or a non-predominant white background. And I think that that's tough stuff to do because there's a low level of trust in government. And for instance, in the case of Tacoma, we have a city charter process going right now. And how do you convince people to vote to give people better jobs and pay them more when they feel like that people are doing a terrible job representing them? But it's what we need. We need to really shift and make the jobs accessible. We need to make the systems accessible. We need to use plain language and we need to fix our infrastructure.
How's your fundraising going?
Oh, good question. I mean, I think it's going great. You know, we've only been going 2.5 weeks and we'll be able to report $15,000 in the next day or so, which is great. We didn't get our website up until a few days ago. And so most of that was done before we even had a web presence. Yesterday and today were my first real days of what we call call time, just being on the call constantly, and got $1,000 raised today. So I think that's great. And all of it is so far has been from friends, family, political supporters, and people who are politically aligned, which means we've got a lot more we can do with a much broader network of like-minded people in Tacoma. That said, you know, the incumbent, Jake Fye, has deep pockets. He had $70,000 about before the session. I'm sure he's going to have a ton more. He can't campaign until next week, but I think he's going to come out the gate with a bunch of money and spending a bunch of money. So it's going to be everyday people-powered campaign that makes us win. It's going to be people giving what they can. You know, my name's Devin. I'm running the 27th. The website is Devin for 27. And our money ask is 27 for Devin. Because it rhymes, because it's what Bernie Sanders raised on average. And because if folks can put that much in monthly, it's going to be what propels us to the top. We need to be on the doors. We're going to win by having conversations with everyday people. We need to be doing mailers. We need to be spending money on all sorts of stuff. And it sucks to say that you've got to make our money early to win. But it's what it is. And it's also what's going to prevent, I think, some of the organizations that might just endorse or give money as a knee-jerk reaction to the incumbent from doing it. So if we can, you know, get a lot of fundraising done right now, I think we'll move some folks that we might not have otherwise moved to support the campaign.
So my next question is not about anything local necessarily, although there is some efforts within the Tacoma City Council on this topic. But I would not be doing my job as a reporter and talking politics right now with you if I did not bring up Palestine and the call for a ceasefire here with the Tacoma City Council and just the insanity of what is going on over in Palestine and Israel. What are your views on this, and is there a path forward?
Yeah. I mean, this is a deeply complex set of issues, and yet also not, because it is just about shared humanity and just about observing an unfolding act of genocide and oppression, you know, and one that's been going on for many decades, but is happening in a way that is so intense and so visceral right now that I think that people's emotional responses are to feel like a mixture of outrage and shutting down. So for whatever reason, I have been a pro-Palestinian liberation person for a long time, and since I got active in organizing in college. And it's been really, really interesting to see how many people are now aware of and fired up about apartheid and genocide and everything that's happening. And I think that it's impossible to not be when you see hospitals bombed, when you see whole families killed, when you get the diagnosis now of, you know, single child, no family, and it's not about their parents, it's about everyone around them. And what you're seeing in Rafah in the last couple of weeks, and, you know, yesterday, I think it was, there was the New York Times piece and Global News, but I saw it in the Times first about a massacre where 100 people were shot and killed and hundreds more were injured. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that it's the moral dilemma and crisis of our moment, as a result of decades of military support, economic support for an apartheid state. And I think it's very important to distinguish Judaism from Israel, you know, and I'm really, really deeply impressed that the movement in the United States and in the UK is largely led by anti-Zionist Jews. And I think there's a lot of terrible false equivocation that happens around being an anti-Zionist and anti-Semite. I'm happy to say that most of my Jewish friends that I've had many over the years have been anti-Zionist. So that's just the culture I've been steeped in. And it's the Jewish left, but it's important to remember that no culture is monolithic. Locally, I think it's weird and complex in Tacoma for various reasons. I really wish the city would just take a ceasefire resolution. I think it's shocking that they haven't yet. Many municipalities around the state and around the country have. You know, some of the biggest unions have come out as pro ceasefire. And I think that, you know, we have, a state legislature that is, I think, failing in this way as well. And our state senator, Yasmin Trudeau, is a Muslim and has been one of the only people in the legislature to come out strongly pro ceasefire. I, again, look forward to possibly being her colleague and am resolutely pro ceasefire. And, end to apartheid and genocide and occupation.
Well, thank you for that. And it would seems like it would be a no-brainer that Tacoma would pass a ceasefire resolution. There have been 70 other cities that have passed this. So it would be very important that our city would say they are against genocide and they want this to stop. One last question before we get out of here. I wanted to ask you about a common passion that you and I have, and that is electronic music. I wanted to read you a quote. I actually found this. I was scrolling on my Facebook feed the other day, and I saw this quote right before the interview, and I was like, this is perfect to ask this next question. But it is a quote by a famous DJ out of Detroit, Jeff Mills, a techno DJ, and he said that techno music was not designed to be dance music, but a futurist statement. And I wanted to get your impression of that statement. And as someone who has been in the electronic music space for a long time, how has this space informed your politics?
Yeah, this is great. I love that statement. And I think both that statement is true and that it's really great dance music. Because I was a 90s rave kid who got really into techno and electro and all different styles of music and the kind of Detroit techno movement. So Jeff Mills, the Belleville 3, deeply influential on me. And I think that the politics of kind of this deindustrializing occupation of spaces, repurposing of spaces, in inclusive ways to push music that sounded different, that sounded like the future, that was this kind of amalgamation of machine and people, and also based on mistakes, right? That the whole kind of music world of Detroit techno and later different styles of electronic music were based on the 808, the 909, and the 303, these instruments that were made for a very specific purpose and ended up not working for that purpose at all and leading to the birth of something new and being kind of reappropriated by folks that you would never expect to reappropriate it based on the dominant market at the time. And a whole new world of music emerged, right, with electro, with techno, with hip-hop. And I think that while there is a constant tension in any music or art culture towards commodification, towards commercialization, and I think it's pretty rampant right now in the electronic music scene, I think that there's also always just innovation. And the innovation comes out of, you know, I don't want to overstate it that it's always working class folks. I've talked to some friends of mine that grew up in Detroit and they're like, oh, those were bougie kids. But I think that there is a response to the kind of economic moment and the political moment where new things are born in art and music. And I think it's really, really, really important. And I, you know, I've always inhabited this space of these kind of progressive, well-meaning, liberal raver folks that have, I think, really good politics and values, but think that radical politics and left-wing movements are uptight and stodgy. And then these politically active spaces in unions and socialist politics that think that the rave scene is bourgeois and indulgent, and they're both correct. But we need, you know, those different intersecting spaces of underground cultures, whatever type of music it is, whatever kind of art it is, as a form of expression and liberation. And we also need the political movements. And I think that Jeff Mills' statement and folks like him who are trying to think about and interrogate what a future looks like, where, you know, we have the technology to do what we want, where we have the space to do what we want. I think it's really important to interrogate that and try to build new things together. So I think it's a great question. I also think business techno sucks.
So before we leave, is there anything else you would like to mention about your campaign? And how can people get in touch with you and find out more about you?
Yeah, thanks. You know, we're launching on the doors. I don't know when this is going to come out first, but on Sunday, March 10th at People's Park at noon, and folks want to join us, they're welcome. My website is www.devin427.org. And we have opportunities for folks to volunteer, to donate, to endorse. And, you know, we are a people-powered grassroots campaign based on a transformational platform. And the way we win is by everyday folks getting involved and contributing their time, their energy, their funds where they can. And I believe that we can win, and we'll win through people. And so please, 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 if things in this interview have sounded exciting to you, go to the website and get involved.
Well, thank you for being here today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.